This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Monsters Among Us, an exploration of otherworldly Bigfoots, Wolfmen, Portals, Phantoms, and Odd Phenomena. By Linda S. Godfrey. Narrated by Emily Durante. Disclaimer. Warning. This book contains eyewitness accounts and historic examples of creatures and entities not yet proven to exist, doing things that should be impossible for any earthly animal. It also discusses phenomena, theories, and ideas that may have some basis in science, but are most likely untestable. It includes reports from many intelligent, sober, and credible people who say they've observed or experienced creatures that change form, communicate, appear and disappear, cloak themselves in mists, and more. The word portal may surface now and again. This book takes the view that such accounts, especially when they display a repetitive pattern over time and widespread locations, deserve to be examined for whatever they may tell us about our own world and about the creatures that seem to come from elsewhere. If you do not believe such topics should be spoken of out loud, or even privately considered, much less written down or discussed, this is not the book for you. If you choose to listen to it anyway, please remember that you entered this portal of your own free will. Return passage is not guaranteed. Introduction. On January 3rd, 2014, something dropped from somewhere into the middle of a snowy field in southeastern Wisconsin. I'd been studying the location for months in an effort to help the property owner figure out the source of strange footprints and happenings there. But trail cameras, nighttime stakeouts, and following the trackways had all proved futile. And although bizarre situations had become the routine rather than the exception in this small, secluded acreage, the apparent landing from nowhere was one of the most baffling events yet. First, the owner and I wondered, why did it choose this field, this winter? Unless it hailed from someplace resembling Hoth, the ice planet in George Lucas's The Empire Strikes Back, the unknown visitor was unlikely to have been attracted by the weather. The Midwest had been suffering through one of the most brutal winters in recent history, with low temperatures and amounts of snow that made it feel more like Antarctica than Wisconsin. In this field, 6 inches of snow topped by a delicate crust should have recorded the tracks of anything weighing more than a field mouse. But surrounded by pristine whiteness, with absolutely no indication of any approach by man, animal, or machine, were what looked like canine tracks that measured about 4 by 5 inches. There were no forepaw prints, just the hind ones, so that it appeared bipedal. The fresh-looking prints were punched deep into the snow and clearly showed a trackway of single-clawed toe pads that ruled out deer, felines, or something else that had stepped precisely into its own front paw prints to create an illusion of larger tracks. And the visitor was evidently not interested in the remains of a deer carcass lying only 50 yards away. Its trackway showed it made a straight beeline north for a thickly wooded area on the other side of the field, which was surrounded by woods and other farmland and was not visible from the road. The property owner, Roy Smith, name withheld by request, was stunned at the implications. Beyond the obvious question of how something could just drop out of the air into a field, he had to wonder why, since the tracks were obviously too small to be human, was the drop-in walking only on its hind legs? When he shared those concerns with me, I was equally mystified. Other than the extremely unlikely scenarios of a tiny skydiver wearing paw-shaped boots, or a person let down from a helicopter while wearing fake paw-print-equipped stilts, I had no idea as to how the track maker could apparently just pop out of nowhere. One word did enter my head, a word I still don't often use alongside reports of unexplainable animals. "I hate to say it," I told Smith, a 70-year-old retired math teacher from Illinois, "and it's not something I'd normally mention on an investigation, but have you ever heard of portals? As in interdimensional portals that might possibly transport beings from some other place or some other type of world?" Expecting either a polite eye roll, a snicker, or a firm rejection, I quickly added that I wasn't saying that his land definitely contained an on-off ramp to an interdimensional highway. I was merely suggesting that we might want to explore some alternative scenarios, since we'd exhausted all the plausible explanations we could think of. Smith wasn't as horrified at the thought as I'd expected he'd be. After everything we'd seen, or sometimes not seen, over the past months on this land, which he'd intended to be a quiet hobby farm, his mind had also started reaching toward twilight areas beyond the norms of the physical world. But as weird as it felt to entertain the notion that something unknown might be creating the oddball tracks, light anomalies, and deer carcass mutilations that would occur time and again in this lonely field, I remembered that other researchers whose work I respect have also found themselves backed into a similar corner of the absurd. Sometimes there's nothing left to do but keep backing right on through that corner. Moreover, we had some very good reasons to start grasping at this particular straw. Smith's trail cams had that very morning captured a series of daytime photographs of something that looked much like a portal, described in another very famous situation of strangeness. This fact made it very difficult not to at least consider the idea. I've previously written about portals, a popular term for unexplained gateways connecting our world, dimension, or time with others, as one of many interesting, if improbable, theories sometimes used to explain the comings and goings of unknown creatures. Leaping into theoretical wormholes, rabbit holes, or any other kind of unidentifiable openings is always risky business, however, and I don't mean that in just a literal falling-to-your-brutal-death kind of sense. The concept of gateways to other worlds, especially in connection with Sasquatch or UFOs, is wildly controversial here in the mundane human world. Skeptical backlash aimed at those who suggest it is often quick, severe, and as painful as I imagine an encounter with any unearthly beast might be. And it's often well justified. People do need to rule out other possibilities and show some sort of reason as to why the P word has been invoked. We will return to this topic throughout the book to do just that. In the end, the argument over whether unknown creatures may travel via unknown transport or must always use physical means of getting around is as hotly contested as is the question of whether the creatures themselves must be completely physical, non-physical, or something in between. The complex and ongoing debate between two main camps has raged for years. To simplify it greatly, one view sees dogmen, Bigfoots, and giant birds as undiscovered species of otherwise normal earthly animals, while the other camp sees them as spirit beings, or perhaps creatures from a world in another dimension, a lower vibratory plane, an extraterrestrial planet, or a hidden underground world. To complicate things further, there are also differing opinions within each camp. Cryptozoology, which, as its name implies, is the study of animals that are hidden from us, and therefore very difficult to study, is a highly individualistic field of inquiry. The same applies to ufology and other related subjects. I think that those who believe dogmen and lake monsters are no more mystical than, say, timber wolves or whales, are also not likely to accept that these creatures may travel by mystical or scientifically unknown means. Those in the second camp, who believe dogmen and lake monsters are not physical animals like timber wolves or whales, are much more disposed to allow for the possibility of magical or presently unknown behavior. There is a smaller third camp, of course, that embraces a variety of combinations of all of those options. I've visited all three camps and considered the pros and cons in each. I find it hard to pitch my tent, much less park a permanent trailer in any one of them, but I do feel most closely aligned to the middle ground that allows for various explanations. And yet, cold rain may fall on that camp space just as it does on the others. The trouble with the middle ground is that even though hypothetical theories might serve to explain one type of phenomena, they either can't be proven or they don't explain encounters with other types of cryptids, UFOs, or unidentified light forms. There's just no single undeniable theory of everything that can be demonstrated to apply to the entire world of unknown phenomena. Despite this rampant ambiguity, cryptid campers of every persuasion usually feel very strongly about their personal beliefs. Some opinions come from personal encounters, while others are the result of reading books, conducting field or scholarly research, or having religious or non-religious convictions. I think that Bigfoots are extremely muscular, solid creatures, at least part of the time, for instance, because of my own experiences and interactions, such as witnessing a 35-foot, 8-inch diameter branch torn off a living oak tree. That act took enormous strength and physicality. And yet many others believe all types of unknown creatures are at least partly spirit beings. A prevailing view I've found among my various Native American friends is that the Sasquatch are both flesh and spirit, moving between the two worlds at will, and that dogmen, or bipedal wolf-like creatures, are the same. I must say that this idea of a hybrid spirit-flesh nature is the paradigm that best supports the totality of witness claims about dogmen and Bigfoots. Still, there will always be exceptions. Suffice it to say that any discussion of portals or morphing creatures in internet chat groups will probably be lively. Toss in debate over other possible behaviors, such as the ability to cloak their visibility or speak telepathically to humans, and things can get hot fast. But some cryptid enthusiasts who began as diehard flesh and blooders have eventually found themselves confronting more instances of unusual circumstances than they could ignore. The late Rob Riggs, who has written about and studied intensively the wild and weird territory in Texas known as the Big Thicket, put it beautifully in Bigfoot, Exploring the Myth and Discovering the Truth. When you start talking about mysterious lights, the door is opened for speculations on UFOs, nature spirits, wormholes in nature, and unusual magnetic fields, as well as ancient forms of man, sorcerers of black magic, and voodoo priests. Too many variables at once make it hard for a normal mind to comprehend. When I first started this work, I never believed I was looking for something that could be a little bit supernatural, but the more time I put into this, the more complex and mysterious it all becomes. Again, I also do my best to keep an open mind. And since there never seem to be galactic shipping labels slapped on any unknown creatures behind, it's hard to say for sure where they come from, especially when we don't know for certain what they are. In my quest to get to the bottom of Smith's hayfield enigma, I decided to look at other credible reports I've had of weird animals acting strangely and see how many were connected to unknown life forms, UFOs, strange atmospheric changes, and other anomalous events. Of course, the cases I've been able to fit into this book are not a complete representative sampling of all possible cases, but they are the best I have recently received from my witnesses. Most are previously unpublished and were received within the past several years, although the incident sometimes occurred much earlier. They are not intended to prove nor disprove any particular theory. My plan is only to present them as a way to test the waters and to look for associations between strange creatures and other phenomena. If enough connections appear, I hope they might serve as an initial platform from which to begin similar but more widespread studies. To help clarify each event, I've added case summaries to the major encounter reports. The summaries compare and contrast the nature of each encounter, note any related anomalous phenomena, and include other pertinent information about the locations, witnesses, and sighting conditions. If an exact date was available for the event, I searched various sources for moon phases, solar flares, and nearby UFO sightings also occurring on or near that date. With this additional information at our disposal, I hope stars will begin to align. Even if they don't, we should know a bit more at the end than we did at the start. Prelude. The case for consideration. As in most cases of unknown phenomena, we usually begin with reports or anecdotal evidence. It's often all we have on a given case. But when it comes to the subject of weird phenomena associated with monster-type creatures, there are plenty of eyewitness sightings and encounters to examine. I've personally heard from hundreds of such people over 23 years. Can we trust these witnesses? Some researchers insist that because there is seldom any hard evidence, reports of unknown animals and other anomalies do not count as actual events, just experiences. I would say, however, that someone who takes the time to report a close encounter with an upright wolf-like creature certainly has viewed that experience as an event. There are, of course, an inevitable number of hoaxers. I sometimes also hear from well-meaning people who are a bit quick to misidentify natural animals as something unknown. There are probably a few additional witnesses who suffer from clinical delusions. I do my best to vet the reports that come my way, and in my experience, those three categories represent only a small number of total cases. Most reports of strange creatures and other weird things seem to come from credible people doing their best to share something that is often still difficult for them to accept. Before we look at my main cases, we'll touch on one well-known series of unexplained events to get an idea of the scope of possible encounters. Utah's Skinwalker Ranch, the site of numerous sightings of light structures thought to be interdimensional portals and appearances of many strange creatures, lights, and UFOs, has been the subject of several books as well as countless articles, blogs, and other media sources. The manifestations occurred from at least 1994 into the mid-2000s and provide the perfect introduction to the subjects we'll be discussing. Needless to say, the details of these events are not without controversy. But the fact that many incidents occurred in full view of human observers, a number of whom were scientifically trained and armed with sensitive instruments, makes it hard to deny that the events did happen in some very real sense. They also show that, at least in this case, some of these anomalies do appear related. A Para-Creature Sampler, Skinwalker Ranch. This may seem like a strange comparison, but back in the day, when expert needlework was a skill admired and required in every household, young women would toil over pieces of stitchery called samplers, that displayed every type of stitch possible. The history of the Skinwalker Ranch functions in much the same way, as a sampler of every type of weirdness for those who study its macabre past. This 480-acre tract of land is replete with examples of cryptids, light forms, and paranormal phenomena. Its story also reveals the many ways in which the other world seems able to frighten and interact with humans. This decades-long brush with weirdness took place in the geologically spectacular Uinta Basin in northeastern Utah, on a ranch partially bounded by a Ute reservation. While newspaper articles began to bring worldwide attention to its weirdness as early as 1996, the book that broke the story wide open was the 2005 bestseller Hunt for the Skinwalker. Its authors were respected biochemist Colm Kelleher and the experienced and Emmy Award-winning newspaper, radio, and television investigator and reporter George Knapp. Kelleher and Knapp teamed up with a highly qualified group of scientists and investigators to interview hundreds of witnesses and record a great number of experiments and observations for 8 years. This despite the fact that, as Kelleher noted in the book's preface, the subject they sought to study was inconveniently unwilling to abide by any of the usual laws of nature as we know them. The investigators had to endure other types of frustration as well. Both men were ridiculed by their colleagues and by skeptics in general for daring to research something so far removed from the usual constraints of mainstream science and journalism. To their credit, they ignored the naysayers and continually tried to adapt to the trickster-like forces that seemed embedded in the property. As hard as they worked, however, their methods seldom persuaded the unknown opponent to show up on cue or leave hard evidence. Their book, then, simply tells what the team was able to observe. The ranch's reputation began with a long history of frightening legends. Despite the beauty of the land's flowing water and bountiful pastures, the neighboring Ute people strictly avoided setting foot on it. They believed it lay smack on a centuries-old trail route favored by what the Navajo call Yenaldlushi, practitioners of a certain type of dark magic whose counterparts may be found in many different Native American tribes. The term means, loosely, something like, it travels fast on 4 feet, due to the belief these people could change into animal form or manifest as floating or flying orbs of light, usually for no good purpose. But every tribe's lore is unique. In English, they are commonly called skinwalkers. As if that weren't enough to scare people away, legends also claimed the land was under an ancient curse. Just how much these legends had to do with later events is open to interpretation and may depend on one's individual belief system. At any rate, the sight of aggressive, creepy animals and weird lights became all too familiar to the family that purchased the property in 1994 with plans to raise prize beef cattle. Family members soon discovered they were raising other, unexpected things. Monstrous creatures began to appear around the ranch almost as soon as Terry Sherman, known by a pseudonym, Tom Gorman, in the book, and his wife and children moved in. The first baffling beast was a huge, apparently bulletproof, wolf-like creature that brazenly attacked a calf near their barn in broad daylight as the family watched from only a few feet away. The variety of intruders increased steadily to include impossibly large-headed, odd stray dogs, huge invisible winged creatures that flapped close to family members' heads, and Bigfoot-like animals. Whether the creatures were from this world or somewhere else, the family soon learned the manifestations were real enough to maim, mutilate, and kill livestock, and that they exhibited little fear of humans. The skies over the Sherman's ranch also teemed with a mismatched fleet of UFOs. According to a 1996 article in the Deseret News titled Frequent Flyers, Sherman and his two children had observed at least 3 different models of UFO, including a small box-like craft with a white light, a 40-foot-long object, and a huge ship the size of several football fields. One of the light objects trailed Sherman's wife as she drove alone in her car, and the Shermans eventually came to associate the presence of the UFOs with the frequent cattle mutilations and deaths that, along with attacks by other unidentifiable things, would eventually take 14 of their herd of 80 registered cattle. The craft-like phenomena, a few of which were caught on video, were more than just distant lights in the night sky. According to Deseret News reporter Zach Van Eyck, they've seen one craft emit a wavy red ray or light beam as it flies along. They've seen other airborne lights, some of which have emerged from orange circular doorways that seem to appear in midair. The Shermans also discovered anomalous round formations in their pastures that resembled simple crop circles. Invisible voices speaking unintelligible words harangued them out of thin air above their heads. Poltergeist-like forces harassed them inside their home. But the phenomena that most resembled events at Roy Smith's field were those oval or spheroid orange doorways mentioned earlier. Colm and Kelleher referred to them as orange structures. These mysterious silent lights would show up just west of the ranch above some cottonwood trees and were observed by all four family members on many occasions. One dark night, by using a powerful scope on his night vision rifle long after sunset, Sherman finally was able to zoom in on one of the orange things. To his great surprise, the object was not uniform at all. In its center was a hole that looked like it opened into some other place, where it was daytime and the sky was blue. During another night, as Sherman surveyed the orange structure, he watched a black, triangular object fly toward him through the window until it emerged from the structure and sailed off into the night sky over his ranch. Sherman eventually realized that the opening to this window or doorway structure was observable only from his property, and that from other angles it appeared as just some sort of orange-tinged mist in the sky. The final straw came in 1996, when the Shermans' three pet dogs were apparently incinerated alive after they chased a blue aerial light. The family felt they had no choice but to give up their dream of the ranching life after spending fewer than 20 months on the property, although Tom would stay on as ranch manager until 1999. Word had also begun to spread about the calamities caused by mysterious forces on the ranch, and people interested in strange phenomena began to approach the Shermans for everything from interviews to amateur investigations. The Shermans finally sold the ranch to the National Institute for Discovery Science, NIDS, an organization owned and funded by American spaceflight entrepreneur and real estate mogul Robert Bigelow. Bigelow immediately moved Kelleher and the NIDS team into a trailer on the property, and they began to dig into the litany of strange events as they also encountered weird lights, mutilated cattle, and a raft of improbable marauders. Before long, the investigators began to feel as threatened as had the Sherman family. In August 1997, a year after the family's departure, two men on the investigative night watch were lucky enough to witness another one of the orange sky tunnels, as it seemed to disgorge some sort of entity. The dumbstruck investigators had been staking out a pasture from a high bluff late one evening when one of them decided to move down to the pasture. The team had noticed that sometimes the act of meditation seemed to stir up activity around them, and the investigator in the pasture settled himself on the grass to do just that. After some time with no apparent results, he gave up and rejoined his teammate, and the pair began to pack their equipment to try another site. Just as they were about to leave, they noticed a faint yellow glow on the land below them. As they peered through their night vision binoculars, they were amazed to see the light growing brighter and larger as it hovered over the ground. It appeared to be a tunnel similar to the one Sherman had seen, and it continued to grow until it had swelled to a 4-foot-wide opening in the dark sky. At that point, a faceless, 6-foot-tall, 400-pound black creature squeezed itself out head first, like an infant emerging from its mother's birth canal, and strolled off into the night as if it owned the place. Perhaps it did. In all, Kelleher would eventually estimate the number of incidents observed and investigated by the science team at more than 100. The only thing lacking was any sort of final proof as to the true nature of the perpetrators. Even an assemblage of 6 trail cameras the researchers had carefully positioned to record a 360-degree view of the ranch's most active spot failed to capture usable evidence. In fact, on one night, 3 of the cameras became targets of the manifestations. They suddenly stopped simultaneously, their expertly taped wires somehow ripped clean from a junction box. At least one of the remaining 3 cameras, left to continue functioning as if some sort of exercise in otherworldly one-upmanship, had been trained directly at the junction box. It caught good video footage that should have shown images of the wire ripper, but didn't. While the video plainly showed the red on lights of the 3 vandalized cameras blinking out in unison, it captured not even an errant light wave, much less an unknown beast or UFO, to hint at how the trick had been accomplished. This reminded me of cases I've investigated that we'll discuss later, when trail cams have shown only translucent mist, weird static, or blank screens at crucial times when the bait was being picked up and carried off. That, despite the fact that the same cameras caught depredations by earthly creatures, such as coyotes, hawks, or humans, perfectly. I've had the same experience with my own trail camera setups in other areas, as have many other investigators attempting to get video evidence of mystery beasts. The cameras will record as they should, as long as only mundane animals are present, and then malfunction only on the expected money shots. I've personally seen the video frames where the snatching of the bait occurs, registering in turn as solid black, solid white noise pattern, and then returning to normal. The Skinwalker Ranch researchers, moreover, were frustrated in their efforts to apply scientific standards and reasoning, no matter what the type of event. The group found 3 calves, one January night in 1997, for instance, with the animal's ears and eyes savagely jabbed and ripped. Temperatures had fallen to below 30 degrees Fahrenheit. Neither of the 2 veterinarians on hand to examine the animals had ever seen any wounds like these, with cuts that resembled the textured marks made by pinking shears. The vets could not agree on the attacker. One said it had to have been coyotes, despite the unusual marks. The other insisted that wasn't possible since it was too cold for any known predators to be out hunting. The sobering takeaway is that, as all but the most hidebound skeptics will admit, things can happen that do not jibe with our everyday beliefs about how the world is supposed to work. I'd like to emphasize that I'm a researcher, investigator, and writer, but I don't have a degree in science. I do theorize and try to draw informed or obvious conclusions and connections from the material I present. These, of course, are only my opinions, suggestions, and educated guesses, and I don't mind if others disagree. At best, I hope my examples and thoughts can point us to the next level of questions and help us see patterns in the phenomena. On then, into the luminous, rolling mist. 1. Worlds Below. Chapter 1. Things from Way Down Under. To the people of most ancient civilizations, there were 2 main places from which strange creatures or godlike beings could hail: the deep belly of the earth, or the sky. Portals, wormholes, and space-time tunnels are most often depicted in today's religious and pop culture art as hovering in the clouds, but in fact are just as likely to be found lying beneath our feet. Caves, underground worlds, the Christian concept of hell, underground military installations, and even alien bases. All of these imply mysterious subterranean passageways of some kind. Whether they are known physical constructs like elevators or sewers, or the more nebulous method of transport to a less than happy afterlife. As above, so below is an ancient mantra that can be interpreted many ways. Many cultures have believed that, like the images in a reflecting pool, if there are portals in the sky that open for beings from heaven or the stars, then there must also be entrances in the ground from which darker beings climb or slither. And according to many mythic and legendary traditions, holes in the earth and hollowed-out mountains or caves have traditionally been considered entrances to hell, or, as Buffy of Joss Whedon's classic sci-fi TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer called them, hellmouths. Hellmouths and other gates to the underworld. When it comes to tunnels and other openings to the underworld, I've noticed something of a turnaround in their traffic patterns over the centuries. Modern myth and legends seem to be all about monsters, demons, and the like taking advantage of hellmouths to escape from disagreeable underworlds. Many episodes of Buffy, for instance, deal with a giant hellmouth deep beneath the local high school that's crammed chock-a-block with demons plotting to spill upward and wreak havoc on humanity. Underworld myths of earlier civilizations, however, focused more on heroic figures struggling to get into these abodes of monsters and dead people, and then, mission accomplished, returning to our world while the horrible entities stayed put where they belonged. I think I like the old ways better. The Gates of Mashu. A good example of the latter can be found in some of humanity's earliest written mythic accounts, in the journey of the ancient Sumerian hero king Gilgamesh. Many scholars believe the character is based on an actual ruler of the southern Mesopotamian kingdom of Uruk, once located in present-day Iraq. He would have lived between 2700 and 2500 BCE. In this epic and iconic tale, Gilgamesh seeks to enter the underworld in hope of finding something still sought by humanity today, everlasting life. But before he enters, this king must become a bit monstrous himself by growing his hair long and dressing in animal skins. Once he makes it to the twin-peaked mountain called Mashu, which marks the entrance to heaven and the underworld alike, he encounters savage guardians, an army of scorpion people, no less, at the mountain's gateway. Gilgamesh, always quite the socially adept schmoozer, manages to avoid a fight and talk his way past them and on into the mountain's interior. He must then hike down a 36-mile tunnel in total darkness in order to complete his quest and learn how to become immortal. I had to stop at this point to wonder at the fact that at least 5,000 years or so ago, people had already formed the notion of other worlds beyond our own that were inhabited not only by our dead, but by gods and monsters, all reachable by traversing long passageways extending deep underground. Today, many world religions also believe that humans may end up stuck permanently in a, usually, ghastly world below when they die. But Gilgamesh is different. In true heroic fashion, he discovers the magical flower of eternal youth and returns with it from the underworld, only to lose it to a serpent who gives the precious bloom to its reptilian kin and thereby cheats humanity of its chance at earthly immortality. We all hate it when that happens. And the motif of the clever, deceptive serpent recurs often in the religious literature of the world. Those that are familiar with the Bible, for instance, are doubtlessly right now picturing forbidden fruit, one persuasive reptile, and a couple who suddenly find themselves naked, afraid, and unemployed as well. But that's another book. The thing that's pertinent in the tale of Gilgamesh, the thing that our modern stories share with these older traditions, is that idea of humans and monsters coming and going from mysterious underground worlds. Contemporary Hellmouths. I've often stated that I don't believe in the idea of actual traditional werewolves, humans changing their flesh and blood bodies for those of flesh and blood canines in an unholy and unsociable union. Sometimes, however, I do receive a compelling report that makes me wonder if something like that is possible in certain situations. And I've always been willing to allow for some sort of spirit-generated facsimile or illusion of a wolfoid that at least looks like a werewolf. If there were such a thing, it seems fitting that they should be said to lurk in the nether regions, in caves, mines, or even sewer systems. I have heard a rumor, for instance, that people have claimed to see werewolves in the sewers of Minot, North Dakota. I've never been able to verify it and haven't even found a single witness, but I've since received some other reports that make it a bit more likely than I thought. The Phantom Wolf of Wolfsegg. Few things would sound more classically spooky than strange moans and howls emanating from a deep, dark cave in the heart of Germany's Bavarian forest. Add a famous floating ghost known as the Woman in White, and then pile on the sighting of a phantom wolf reported by a soldier with Canadian forces stationed near there in 1987. All the ingredients for a vaunted passage to an underground world are present and accounted for. The intriguingly named village of Wolfsegg in southern Germany is most famous for its 800-year-old castle, a must-see for many tourists. The soldier's wife, S., wrote me to relate that his troop was stationed that year at a U.S. military garrison facility called the Hunfels Training Area, not far from Wolfsegg. He and his comrades were camping overnight in a farm field nearby the training facility, and on one particular evening, he had chosen to bunk inside his M-458 military track vehicle. He was awakened during the night by a strange scratching sound at the vehicle's window. His wife wrote, "Suddenly, a large canine head appeared in the window. It looked dog or wolf-like, but had glowing red eyes. The eyes frightened my husband the most. It made bold eye contact for a couple of seconds, then disappeared from view. It would have had to have been 6 to 7 feet tall, standing on its hind legs to reach the window of the track vehicle from the ground." The next morning, my husband tried to tell himself that he must have dreamed the whole thing, but he found tracks and paw prints all over the muddy ground outside his vehicle. He told his fellow soldiers about the spooky creature, but nobody knew what to make of it. The thought of a huge, possibly phantom wolf roaming a military training ground and window-peeping at slumbering soldiers does sound a bit fantastic. I call it a possibly phantom wolf partly because of its red eyes. Canid eyeshine is normally light yellow to greenish, or golden yellow, although sometimes physical eye conditions or illness can change any animal's eyeshine hue. But as wolves were once very numerous throughout Europe, so were legends of large, black, red-eyed phantom wolves or dogs, believed by most clergy of the Middle Ages to be demonic. The noted German scholar Dr. Johann Keiler von Kaiserberg, for instance, preached a sermon on that subject in Strasbourg in 1508. A local cleric published the good doctor's words, including this interesting sentence. "He certainly says that the demon often appears in the shape of a wolf, and in his sermon on wild men of the woods, he speaks of lycanthropes in Spain." Synchronistically, S. added that Wolfsegg coat of arms features a wolf, actually the head of a black, shaggy wolf with a protruding red tongue. The Wolfsegg Hole. But there's more than just history to link the Wolf's Egg area to possible phantom creatures. As mentioned earlier, there's a well-known legend of a woman in white said to appear around the castle grounds. The apparition is thought to be the ghost of a woman killed in 1485 for marital transgressions. Wolf's Egg also is famed for a deep cave located about 100 yards into the forest just outside the village. Residents nicknamed the cave the Hole due to its steep drop into a black, seeming abyss. It is at least 35 meters deep, and despite a few expeditions meant to discover its outlet, local tourism publications say it has never been fully explored. A site called Travel Creepster claims, "There is a strange noise coming from the darkness of the hole, sometimes just breathing, and sometimes grunts or growling, but the last thing witnesses would describe it as is human. The locals will tell you that the sounds are not natural of any creature they have ever heard, and they tell the story of travelers that got too close and were never seen again." According to the site, one expedition led by scientists in 1920 entered the cave on the premise that the opening shaft was too steep to be used as a regular entrance by whatever animals were heard breathing in there, and that therefore another, more horizontal level must exist. They did find horizontal tunnels, but they were much deeper than expected, and they were filled with animal bones that they judged had been left in the cave over a very long period of time by unknown carnivores. There are numerous other caves and old mines in the area as well, since this was once a very active iron mine region. And while I don't want to give the impression that tunnels to possible netherworlds are absolute requirements for sightings of werewolves in progress, people have sent me some stunning examples of cases where underground access seems to have played a part. Encounter Case Summary: Phantom Wolf of Wolf's Egg. Reported creature or creatures: large wolf-like creature that left paw prints and also mud prints on vehicle. Location, date: Hunfeldt's training area near Wolf's Egg, Germany, 1987. Conditions: nighttime, clear weather. Associated phenomena: ghost apparition, extremely deep sinkhole with horizontal tunnels filled with animal bones, and the sight of unidentified grunts and growling. Unexplained actions, appearance of creature. Height of 6 to 7 feet, glowing red eyes, unlike yellowish reflective canid eyes, and stood upright to peer into military truck window. Witness or witnesses: a Canadian soldier on training duty. Environmental factors: combination of woods and farms to provide possible small livestock as prey, and close proximity to a legendary deep sinkhole with a tunnel system near a military base. Chapter 2. Liminal Los Angeles. Zooming back to the United States, we can explore a better documented tale. First person, with two witnesses and a pinpoint geographical location, sent to me several years ago by a woman who had a close encounter with an apparent shapeshifter as it tried to hoist itself out of a manhole. It happened in Torrance, California, when she was just 7 and her brother was 14. "He won't talk publicly about it to this day," she says, but she remembers it clearly. I've left it in mostly her own words, edited slightly for spelling, brevity, and punctuation, with only a few added interjections of my own. The Torrance Werewolf. Well, it was a sunny afternoon in 1985, and I was with my brother and my mother at a laundromat in Torrance, California, that we occasionally went to. We had just came from a store where my mom bought my brother and I our first Nerf ball to share. We were very excited and anxious to play with it. Well, we were helping Mom put the clothes in the washer and getting change, etc. Then my brother and I started begging our mom to let us play with the Nerf ball in the parking lot. She, of course, said no because it was too dangerous, so my brother said that he would be right back. He went looking around for a spot to play and came back quickly. He said to my mom that he found a safe spot right behind the laundromat, and it was an apartment-type complex with a long driveway where we would be safe from cars. She finally accepted. We ran as fast as we could to the back of the laundromat. I remember my brother saying to me that he wanted me to go to the middle of the driveway and that he would be toward the front, just in case cars would drive in. That way he could be seen better because he was taller. We started to play catch back and forth, throwing the ball different ways with spins and twirls and such. I remember we got pretty loud because we were having such fun. We were running and jumping, and we kept hitting the sides of the wall to this property and the open carports that were underneath the complex. After about 30 minutes or so, my brother threw it so high and far that I had to fetch the ball from the last carport. The ball flew in all the way back to the carport wall, just beneath the storage compartment that each carport had. So I ran to go get it. I got the Nerf ball in my hands and turned around. Right there was a large metal rectangular door on the ground that looked like it opened to an underground area. Well, there was a man that lifted the door and popped a little out from underneath this heavy, thick metal door, and it was propped sort of on his back, neck, and shoulders, to where I could only see his upper body. I was at that moment freaked out and afraid. I was told to never talk to strangers. I was told constantly to never trust anyone by my mother, brother, and grandma. I wasn't allowed to go anywhere alone. So I was very frightened and stood still, looking at this man. The door was heavy, so it seemed as if he couldn't get enough strength to get all the way out of it. My only way to get past him was from the sides, because this door was directly in the middle of the end of the carport, facing outward. He looked at me and said in a rough voice, "What's all this noise? Why are you making so much noise? What are you doing? Why are you here?" I didn't say anything. I just stared. He said, "Are you playing?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, it's okay. You don't have to be afraid of me." "It's okay, Jennifer. You don't need to be afraid." I looked at him, puzzled, because I wondered how he knew my name. I never said it. My brother was yelling at me to hurry up, but he never yelled out, "Jennifer." I noticed this man's outfit. From what I could see, he was wearing an off-white, long-sleeved, blouse-type shirt with cufflinks or buttons to tighten the wrist area of the shirt. He had a brown velvety or silk-type vest over the shirt that was buttoned up. He looked like a European or Italian man, but spoke with clear English, no accent at all. He had dark brown hair that was slicked back in a very clean-cut manner. He had dark brown eyes. His skin was pale, but not too pale. He was rather handsome, I thought. Thinking about it later on in my life, he looked similar to a Dracula or vampire that's been portrayed in movies, but young. He looked to be in his late 20s. He also had a manipulating, nice, light voice when he was calling me to come toward him. I was just standing still and not wanting to move close to him at all. My brother was yelling for me to hurry up, but he kind of stopped and was waiting for me because he saw from the side this man that was talking to me. Back then, children were supposed to respect their elders or adults, so my brother stood quiet for what seemed forever to me. As Jennifer continued to stare at the man in horror, she also had a very close look at the tunnel around him. I could see a little bit on the side of him, and it looked like there were stone stairs leading to the bottom, but they didn't go all the way to the top, she said. At the bottom, I could see a very small lantern-type light, and the rest was pitch black. After a while, the man seemed agitated with me for not wanting to listen to him. He then started to say, "Oh, no, not now. Not right now. Loudly. I was getting even more frightened because I didn't understand what he was talking about or who he was telling this to. All of a sudden, he didn't look too good. He was sweating pretty bad. His skin was looking weird. He looked as if he was in tremendous pain. His veins in his neck and forehead were protruding out, like thicker. He was looking at me and kept telling me that to not be afraid and he won't hurt me. Now I was starting to shake and clenching the Nerf ball in my hands. He was pretty much the whole time holding his arms out to grab me, so I didn't want to pass by him. He started to scream in a deep-pitched voice because of the changes that were happening to him and his body. He looked at me, and I seen his eyes change from dark brown to yellow in an instant. I seen his jawbone and or bones underneath his skin changing form. I could hear bones snapping or breaking. I seen his face changing into a creature little by little. That's when my brother yelled to him from the side, "What's happening? What's going on?" The man-beast lifted the door a tad bit more and turned toward my brother and growled at him with so much anger. My brother yelled out, "Leave my sister alone," and ran to get help at the laundromat. The beast turned back toward me. He was now almost turned into a dog-type creature. I seen hair growing at a high rate of speed out of his body, everywhere, and his teeth growing bigger as well. His gums were bleeding because the teeth were getting bigger. My brother ran back with no one else by his side, and I knew at that moment I needed to try and get away from this beast before he changed completely. He was staring at me while he was changing and getting worse looking by the minute, and in all of that time after he was no longer a man, he was telepathically communicating with me, talking to me through his eyes. He was telling me that he was going to get me, that he was going to eat me if I didn't listen to him and go with him right now. My brother started yelling at him some more. This beast's arms were starting to change, and he turned towards my brother and began growling at him, but now it was really deep and had much more bass to it, with an echo, probably from being near the carport. As soon as he turned toward my brother, I seen my brother motion with his hands for me to come toward him. I right away made a run for my life toward my brother. The beast grabbed my ankle tightly, but I managed to slip away from his fingers that were turning into longer, more strong nails, or paws of some sort. Also, his arms started burning and smoking in a way because where he was grabbing me, his skin was hitting the light, so that he couldn't even hold on to me for long. I grabbed the side of the carport wall for support and probably left gashes in it. I ran to my brother and never looked back because I was afraid he was going to completely turn into this wolf or dog or Doberman-type creature and bite me. My brother grabbed my hand and we made a marathon run for it back to the laundromat. My mom was still doing laundry, and we were pleading with her to just leave the clothes. We were yelling at everyone in that whole place to leave and go to their cars because we saw a mad dog creature. They looked at us like we were crazy, including our own mom. My brother told my mom that she should really listen to what we're saying because it's true. He grabbed the keys to the car and said that we would go sit in the car and watch her from there. We felt safer being in the car. My brother said in case we had to drive off, he would take us. My brother was only 14, but he was big enough to drive. He was completely frightened, and so was I. We were just watching and waiting. The creature never came toward the laundromat. My mom came to the car, and we drove off. My brother told my mom everything, and she questioned me as well, but didn't believe us very much. She stopped going to that laundromat because of what we said. She also asked us later on about the Nerf ball. I told her I left it. She was curious as to why we left it, knowing that we just got it and that we waited so long to be able to buy it. She also saw pinkish marks around one of my ankles. That had her wondering for days. Later on in my life, I asked her about the incident, and she says that she remembers how frightened we were, how we were shaking, but she still doesn't believe us, I think.